Well, we're still going through the gifts of the Spirit in 1 Corinthians chapters 12, 13 and 14, and we're nearly there. We're almost at the end of chapter 14 now, but we're not going to finish tonight. So you've got a little bit longer yet. One more week, I think. So after tonight. So far, we've been looking at how Paul has been carefully drawing out, if you like, the theology behind the use of the gifts. And in particular, he's been looking at the gift of tongues and contrasting that with the gift of prophecy. And what he's done, as we look through these three chapters, is he's taught us the purpose of the gifts. And the purpose of the gifts is to build up the church. We've seen that the gifts are to be used unselfishly and in love, and not simply for personal gratification. We've seen as well, haven't we, the importance of our minds as well as our spirits or emotions in worship. But it's not simply good enough just to enjoy ourselves on an emotional level in worship, which so very often happens, but we must be understanding of what goes on as well. And he's pointed out to the Corinthians that their fixation with the gift of tongues and all that meant to them was really quite childish. And he said it's time for them to grow up and not to be so fixed upon this one thing. And he explained, hasn't he, how they were missing or misusing this gift and missing the point of it. And he's pointed out the dangers of their actions too. Possibly, even to the extent that it could turn people away from the church. Tonight we're going to look for now from verse 26, where we finished up last week. And he starts to explain here how this teaching that he's been giving now works out in a practical way in the way that they worship. So it's how it works out in practice is what he's starting to talk about now. There aren't many places in Scripture that tell us much about the form and the style of worship in the New Testament. So these few verses are really quite important. We aren't given any idea how typical the Corinthian style of worship was in the early church, but had it been sort of way off beam, I think Paul would have said so, wouldn't he? So it's quite likely that the style of worship we read about here was perfectly acceptable, if not the norm, in New Testament churches. So this passage really provides us with a unique insight into the way that the New Testament church worshipped, and maybe there's something we can learn about the way we worship, or perhaps ought to worship today. So he starts off then, doesn't he? And he says, what shall we say then, brothers? What shall we say, brothers? This is the question that Paul asks the Corinthians, and this is the question we have to ask ourselves. In view of the teaching of chapters 12, 13 and 14, what is it we should be doing? When you come together, he says, when you come together. Now, Paul is talking here about corporate worship, when the church comes together. He's not talking about Sunday school classes or prayer meetings. He's not referring to the Women's Cross Stitch Society or Men's Curry Nights. He's talking about the church coming together to worship as a whole. Meeting as a family to worship God. And the first point to notice, really, I suppose, is that he expects the church to meet together. He expects the people to be coming together and worshipping together. I suppose the idea of house churches is quite a popular one today, with the emphasis is on meeting in small worship groups in people's houses very often. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It's often a good idea to meet in smaller groups. It helps to build relationships in a way that can't be done in larger groups, and that's a good thing to happen in the church. However, meeting in smaller groups shouldn't take the place of meeting for corporate worship. They should be an addition to meeting together. House groups should be an integral part of the church, but not the only focus of the church. Paul is quite clear that he wants the people to meet together because there's benefit in worshipping together as a family. It's interesting to note as well that Paul is actually writing to the church at Corinth, and that included all the Christians in the city. Of course, at this time, there weren't separate denominations. If you were a believer, if you were a follower of Christ, you were part of the church where you lived. The church in Corinth was all the Christians in Corinth. The church in Andover is all the Christians in Andover. Now, that isn't to say that all the Christians in one place should necessarily all meet together. There are often practical considerations involved, aren't there? Especially in a big town or a big city like Corinth, where there may have been hundreds, possibly even thousands of Christians. And in fact, in verse 33, Paul talks about the idea of congregations. Not verse 33, is it? Yes, it is the end of verse 33. He talks about the idea of congregations. And clearly we're a church, in the sense of all the Christians, was too big to meet together regularly. They met in congregations instead. Now, how big is a congregation? Well, we've no idea. But again, it probably comes down to practical issues, doesn't it? How big is the place you meet in? You know, we couldn't get 500 people in this hall, could we? That would be ridiculous to try and even think of doing something like that. But what matters is how we can join together and worship together and be a family of God's people without that becoming simply sterile and informal and perhaps impersonal. There's no real formula for answering this, because it will all depend on the people in a particular fellowship. And there's been loads of studies on group dynamics, and you can go along to these excellent conferences about, you know, churches and group dynamics and how you should do this in certain group sizes and this in other group sizes and this when you've got big churches and this when you've got thousands, and there's all these wonderful ideas. But there's no way of deciding on an ideal size, if you like, of a congregation. I don't think you can sort of say this is the right number. What I would say, and I think as a generality, it would seem that when you meet together on a regular basis, it's probably most effective when you have a maximum between 100 and 150 is a maximum. That's what I've seen from probably my own experience. When you get more than that, people can begin to feel they're not part of it. And, you know, it can become very, as I said, impersonal. And they feel they're not really part of the fellowship. Not that I'm saying it's wrong to meet in larger congregations. You can, in fact, get tremendous encouragement, can't you, from big gatherings of Christians. You know, when you go to the men's conference or the women's conference and you've got sort of 4,000 or 5,000 people there gathered together singing and praising God, it's a wonderful experience. But I would suggest that it shouldn't be the way it would be every week. I don't think massive churches like that really benefit the individual. I think it's ideal to meet in smaller congregations for regular worship, and also to meet informally in smaller groups such as house groups at other times during the week. The next thing we need to note is that as far as Paul is concerned, everybody is involved in the worship. What Paul is getting at here is that when we come together for corporate worship, everyone should be able to be involved. He's not saying that everyone must do something, but he is saying that everyone can join in one way or another. And he lists the things the Corinthians were doing during their worship service in verse 26, doesn't he? When you come together, everyone has a hymn, a word of instruction, a revelation, a tongue or interpretation. And these are things that were happening for them in their church services. And he's saying that this is something everyone should be able to be involved in and join in with. And there's no suggestion that what they were doing was wrong. But he does make the point that whatever they do must be done for the strengthening of the church. And again, he's coming back to that central issue, isn't he? This whole passage has been about this one thing, really, of that the gifts must be used for the strengthening and the building up of the church. And he's coming back to that once again. He's saying, you know, what you're doing, that's fine, but make sure when you do it for the right reasons, and you do it to strengthen and to encourage one another. The problem is, as we've seen already, the Corinthians had become, if you like, selfish in their worship. All wanting to be heard, all wanting to get what they wanted to say not really caring about what each other had to say. They were more concerned with themselves than they were with each other. And rather than building the church up, what was happening was it had become sort of irreverent chaos, and it was breaking down rather than building up. So Paul insists that things have to be done in an orderly fashion. We can see as well that this idea of corporate worship is not simply to have one person up the front doing everything, but rather to allow other people to join in. And clearly, the sort of worship that was going on in the New Testament was clearly more spontaneous than maybe we're used to in the churches today. That isn't to say that we should allow chaos to reign either. Things must be orderly, but also flexible. That's the pattern we find here in the church at Corinth. Orderly but flexible is what Paul is talking about. We should be using the gifts we've got. We should be using those gifts in worship so that the church might be built up and strengthened. But it shouldn't be chaotic. What does that mean? It means if somebody wants to sing a particular hymn or a chorus, they should be able to ask to do that. That, of course, puts the musicians on the spot, but that's always a good thing anyway. If somebody feels it's appropriate for them to read a certain passage of scripture, they should be able to do that and to share as they do that. We shouldn't be restrictive in stopping people doing that. You see, true worship isn't the sort of hymn-prayer sandwich that's predictable week in and week out. Real worship is a dynamic response to God's love. It's a dynamic response to God's love. So I suppose the question is, why aren't we like this? Well, I suspect for several reasons. First of all, we're not used to it. So we find it a little bit uncomfortable, the idea of sharing something or you know, being a person that says, I'd like to share this reading, or can we sing this chorus? We find that difficult sometimes, don't we? I guess most of us, if we've been in the church for any length of time, have been brought up on a diet of hymn prayer sandwiches. And however dull we may have found that, we find it hard to change. We find it hard to be anything different in our approach to the way we worship. But when things do become predictable, the same week in and week out, what does our worship become? It simply becomes a religious exercise, and it loses its real meaning. We might be frightened of what's going to happen. What will happen if we allow people to say something? You know, it's going to be completely chaotic and disorderly, and you know, it'll be awful. And that can happen. And we've seen it in churches where that's allowed to go on like that. It can be exactly what happened in Corinth. Chaos reigned, and nobody was sort of reining it in, really. But what you should have is, you know, leaders who are capable of making sure that chaos doesn't reign, that things are done still in a proper and a structured way. The leaders should be encouraging orderly and reverent worship. And they should be prepared to stop anything they feel is inappropriate. And that's another thing we need to be prepared to go along with. You know, if one of you decides you'd like to share something and I happen to be at the front and I say, well, I don't think that's very appropriate for today, you've got to be prepared to say, okay, I'll sit down and I won't share that. And that's the way we need to be, and we need to have that relationship. Of course, another problem is we may be too shy to join in. And that's a lot of people feel that way, don't they? You know, we feel that, oh, well, I can't pray because people think I'm silly if I was to say something. I can't share anything because it's not really, you know, it's not very spectacular, the things God's been doing in my life. We might feel that we're not comfortable to do that either. You know, I like to say to people, when we're praying, we're not praying to one another, we're praying to God. And God loves to hear us pray, even if it's just to say thank you for something very simply. And you know how encouraging that is for other people? Do you ever get encouraged just by hearing somebody pray a very simple prayer of thanks? Because I do. And that can encourage and lift us up as well. You know, if we were able to have this atmosphere of real worship, people will gradually feel more able to be part of that and more comfortable in sharing in that. And when God lays something on our hearts, he'll give us the courage to share it as well. It's really encouraging to hear how God is working in people's lives, just even if it's a very simple, everyday event sometimes. Just to hear that from somebody else is a lovely thing. Now, I'm not advocating a free-for-all where there's no order or discipline. Rather, what we should have is a framework in our worship that both allows and encourages everyone to feel part of it and to feel they're able to share what God's given to them and therefore to encourage each other. And that's what I think Paul is getting at here. That's the framework Paul is putting in place. He's saying, don't be chaotic, but worship properly in a structured way, but allow freedom in that worship so that we don't become stagnant and stale and predictable and boring. Then, of course, he has to get back to tongues, doesn't he, in verse 27. Once again, tongues was at the forefront of where the Corinthians were going wrong. And clearly in their efforts to use this gift, they were actually lacking consideration for one another. They were probably all speaking over each other, nobody listening to anybody else, no fault for what was being said. They probably couldn't understand what was being said. Everyone was talking at once. So even if there had been an interpretation, it would have got lost in the general babble. Basically, no one would understand what was going on. Well, we've already seen, haven't we, the importance of being able to understand what is said. So Paul lays down some rules to ensure that this happens. In verse 27, he says, if anybody's going to speak in a tongue, it's got to be done, first of all, one at a time. And there has to be an interpretation. And, at the most, three people can do this. And he clarifies it further by saying, in verse 28, if there is nobody to interpret, then the speaker must keep quiet in the church. What does that tell us about the spontaneous use of gifts in worship? What Paul is saying here is that the use of this gift in a worship service must be organised properly. For example, how in practical terms, if you just decide you're going to speak in a tongue, can you ensure that an interpreter is present? How do you know it's going to be interpreted? I think that to ensure that the requirements Paul lays down here are met, any person wishing to bring a message in tongues has to know beforehand. And firstly, he's got to make sure that he's going to bring this message that he believes God's given him. There's got to be somebody there he knows is able to interpret so that everybody benefits from the message. Secondly, he's got to check with the leaders that it's appropriate for him to do this. If he happens to be number four on the list, he's out of luck that day, isn't he? Paul wants the Corinthians to limit the use of this gift and discern where it might be appropriate and it might not. And that's why he's laying down these rules. He wants them to think about it, not just babble on incessantly with no thought. He wants them to think if it's right for them to do this, to prepare what they might be bringing. And if people are able to meet those requirements, then they can bring that message during worship. If not, he says, you're to keep quiet and speak to yourself and God. 2 points to notice from that statement. Firstly, what does he say in the church? That's what he says, doesn't he? In the church he's talking about. Well, simply because these regulations don't apply outside of the church. On the day of Pentecost, when the wonders of God were being proclaimed to people in their own tongues, the disciples were speaking at once. They were talking to people in their own languages. They were spreading the message of the gospel in their own language. And there was no interpretation because the people who were hearing in their own language. There was no need for interpretation because everyone, it says, heard the message in their own language. No one was left out. There wasn't anybody who couldn't understand the message because it was given to everybody in their own language. In a church, one message is to be given in one tongue at one time. And the reason there has to be an interpretation is so that the people who don't speak that language can understand what that message is all about. Secondly, he says, if there's no interpreter, you're to keep quiet in the church and speak to himself and God. Now, does that suggest it's okay to pray in tongues? Is that what he's saying? Is he saying, don't say it out loud, but pray in tongues quietly? And that is certainly the way many people read that verse. And often it's used as a justification for praying in tongues. But the question is, and when you look at the Bible, when you find something which may be a little bit difficult, you have to say, does the interpretation of this verse tie up with what Paul's already said? He's been teaching us about the use of this gift all the way through the last three chapters. Does that interpretation tie up with what he read already? Well, no, it doesn't. We've seen, haven't we, the purpose of tongues is to bring a message from God. It's not a message to God. There's no purpose in relaying a message from God back to him. We've also seen that it's essential to understand the tongue, or else the mind is unfruitful. So to pray in a tongue that you don't understand, whilst it might possibly make you feel good, is of no benefit to you, to the congregation, and certainly not to your mind. So the conclusion must be that Paul is not suggesting that a person prays in tongues. Rather, what he's saying is, if you don't get to bring your tongue, your message, for whatever reason, go along to the service and sit quietly in prayer and meditation. Join in with the rest of the worship, but you personally are not there to speak that day. Be quiet and meditative and use that time that way. Well, I think you can see, if the Corinthians followed these regulations, then their use of the gift of tongues in a service, if and when it was needed, would be orderly and it would be beneficial rather than chaotic and fruitless. And then he goes back to prophecy in verse 29. And again, he's contrasting the use of prophecy with the use of tongues. And he applies similar principles to the use of prophecy. Once again, we see there's a limit to the number of prophets allowed to speak during one service. At most, there are to be three. And what they say is to be carefully considered by those who are listening. Also, if one of them is speaking and a revelation comes to somebody else who is sitting down, then that second person gets priority and the first speaker has to stop and be quiet. I'll come back to that in just a minute. But you see, what's happening again here is there's organisation behind what is going on. There's structure. There's a framework involved here. And the implication is that those who bring prophecies will have been arranged again before the service starts. Prophecy is not necessarily a spontaneous thing, but quite likely could have been prepared beforehand. And this fits in again with what we've seen about prophecy previously, a message from God to his people. And it can come through revelation, or it can come through study. God can impart a message to somebody through study that he wants to bring to the people. It hasn't got to be a revelation, because we contrast revelation here, don't we? I'll come back to that in just a second. But the message that is brought, as we've seen before, has to be checked up on. It's not enough just to believe what is said in the name of prophecy. And again, this proves that the prophecy referred to here is not infallible. And we have a responsibility to make sure that what we're hearing is what God is saying to us. And the only way we can test that is by the scriptures. And that is our responsibility. As with the Bereans, well, they were commended because they checked up on what Paul said. They used the scriptures to do so. And church leaders have a special responsibility in this respect, to ensure that what is being fed to their flock is correct. The prophecies that were being brought were important. They were bringing messages from God, but they didn't have to be revelation. So why is it then that if somebody else in the congregation has a revelation, it says, the person who's bringing the first prophecy has to sit down? The second person has priority. Why is that? Well, I like to think about it as like news at 10. Well, Trevor MacDonald, if he still does news at 10, is sitting there reading a news item which has previously been prepared, and all of a sudden an important news flash arrives. So what does he do? He stops reading the first one and he reads out the important news flash. He's interrupted by something that is considered to be immediately more important. And that's what Paul's saying here. He's saying, you know, somebody might be bringing a message from God, but somebody sitting down receives a revelation. That's an immediate message. That's because God has got something more immediate and more important to say. So what's previously been prepared can be put on hold for a moment. Well, the news flash comes in. It doesn't lessen the validity of what the first person was saying, but that becomes, if you like, secondary to the revelation that God gives. And we tend to think of all prophecy as revelation. That's what we tend to think of as prophecy today. And it's clearly not what Paul means by prophecy. Revelation is a particular type of prophecy. Other prophecy can be prepared in advance through study, through God bringing a message through somebody to the people that he wants them to hear. And he's making the point, isn't he, again, that these prophecies can all be brought in turn, but it must be done again in an orderly fashion, so that everyone, he says, may be instructed and encouraged. And those two things are vital to remember when we're talking about messages from God. They bring instruction and encouragement. And there it is again, you see, prophecy is for the benefit of all when it's used properly. So he's really saying, what we have here, what I want from you is order, not chaos. Order is always to be maintained. He says, the spirit of the prophets are subject to the control of the prophets. What he means by that is, you're not compelled to speak. You're not compelled to do anything. Prophets are in control of what they say. And if something more important crops up, they recognise that and they're prepared to stop and to allow something else to be said. You know, I've heard stories of where people have said they've been taken over by God and they're no longer in control of what they say. And that's often very prevalent within the experience of things, you know, like the Toronto Blessing a few years ago and in that type of thing. And some people say they just lose control completely and they end up laughing uncontrollably or able to stop themselves doing anything. That is not scriptural. That is not the way God works. Clearly, that is not what God says he does. God is a God of order, not of chaos. He doesn't turn us into robots with no choice, but he allows us to have control over the things that we say and the things that we share and the messages that he gives us to bring to other people. So what's our conclusion from this today then? Well, firstly, God does not want disorderly worship. But neither does he want stagnant rituals. He doesn't want disorderly worship, but neither does he want stagnant rituals that have no meaning or real life in them. There should be a structure, a framework in our worship that allows both spontaneity within order. That is the pattern we see Paul laying down to the Corinthians. And we need to understand God through our worship and experience God in our worship. Both are vital, that we understand God through our worship and we experience God in our worship. And that's what Paul is really getting at in the whole of these three chapters. His conclusion that he's coming to is this: that worship should be something alive and vibrant. We're worshipping the living God. His presence is amongst us. And that should make the way we worship alive and vibrant and exciting. And we should be receiving messages from God, whether prepared beforehand or sometimes in the service itself. But it must all be done in an orderly way, so that chaos doesn't ensue. We're all human and we get things wrong. And sometimes people's excitement bubbles over and they can perhaps say and do things that aren't really what God would want at all. And so we have to be prepared to make sure that we keep the order in the church. But we should not lose the spontaneity and the life and the vibrance in our worship. We shouldn't allow the structure to become just a religious form that has no meaning behind it. And that's what God is saying to us today. That's what God wants from us. He wants us to worship Him in a living and vibrant way. But He wants us to do it within an order and a structure which is reverent and honouring to Him as well.